Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 24th of February 1924, a rich and powerful businessman seeks to close down the pesky competition, and a Labour-run local authority gets to spend. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. Last week's threatened dock strike has gone ahead. One of the key protagonists is the trade unionist Ernest Bevin. He will go on to be Foreign Secretary in the late 1940s, playing a part in the creation of both NATO and the British nuclear deterrent. Gustav von Kahr, dictator of Bavaria, and the man who put down the beer hall putsch, has, for reasons that are not entirely clear from a perusal of the Times, resigned. From a perusal of Wikipedia, we learn that it was a result of pressure from the central government. The fact that there is no mention of a replacement, and that his appointment was an emergency measure, suggests that he may have been a victim of his own success. The French franc, for that was what the French did for currency in those days, has, amid a severe government financial crisis, slumped to 100 to the pound. The Times is keen to point out that the occupation of the Ruhr has not been the moneymaker that the French intended. Rather, the opposite is going on with the pound, with The Times reporting that British bidders for South African rail contracts, South Africa is part of the British Empire, have been severely undercut by foreign, including German, competitors. Further evidence that the pound is massively overvalued. There's been an explosion in a factory near Erith on the Thames. 13 people, mainly women, have been killed. According to The Times, they were working on breaking down very lights or distress signals. I'm going to guess these were surplus from the war. If under attack, men in the front line would send up distress signals in the hope that the artillery would then bring down fire on the enemy crossing no man's land. Artillery was the big killer in the First World War. And I'm getting off topic. I saw this in Wednesday's edition. At the Southwark County Court yesterday, Mrs. Loretta Bean of Harper Street, New Kent Road, SE, was awarded £300 damages against a Lambeth baker for the death of her husband, who was killed by being caught in a dough mixer. £300 equates to about 60 ounces of gold, which, even without applying the Crozier fudge factor, is about £100,000, which doesn't sound like a great deal of money. A Sir Alfred Yarrow, of Yarrow Shipbuilders fame, has offered to build what we would nowadays call a flyover at Oxford Circus in central London. Of course, to us, flyovers are ugly concrete structures, and the area under them and near them deeply depressing places to be. But they didn't know that in those days. All they knew was that, as mentioned in the 20th of January episode, amongst others, motorised transport had made congestion in the capital much worse. If it were up to me, I'd not bother with clever traffic management and just hike up the congestion charge until traffic ran freely. I would, however, bother with this. This is from Tuesday the 19th of February. 7 members of the police force at Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, have been arrested for thefts from houses and garages extending over the past year. And finally, this is from Friday the 22nd. A schoolboy named Pullman, belonging to one of the higher forms in a Berlin public school, has committed suicide by throwing himself from the roof of the school because he received a bad report which he feared to take home. One of the big controversies this week has been over the new Labour government's decision to rescind the Poplar Order. What is that, I hear you ask? Well, if you hang on for a bit, I will attempt to explain. In 1924, poverty relief is, for the most part, the responsibility of poor law boards. They come under a variety of names, boards of guardians, poor law unions, etc., but they are locally elected and locally funded government organisations that alleviate poverty. This can be in the form of the workhouse, indoor relief, and yes, workhouses were still a thing, or in the form of payments, outdoor relief. That sounds all fine and dandy, but what about the case of Poplar? The Board of Guardians' argument is that Poplar, which is in London's Docklands, is a poor area, and that means two things. First, they have more poverty to deal with. Second, raising the money puts an excessive burden on their ratepayers. In 1921, claiming the position they were in was intolerable, they refused to pass on money they had collected to other London bodies. The guardians were then jailed. There were protests, and they were released, and were thereafter able to draw upon funds raised from other parts of London. However, the government set down a scale of relief to control costs. It is this scale that the new Labour government has rescinded. In other words, through breaking the law and by dint of a supportive central government, Popular has got itself into the situation where it can spend what it likes and get others to pay for it. Something that sounds oddly familiar. For what it's worth, I'm in two minds on this matter. On the one hand, the best solution to poverty is prosperity, and the best, only way to ensure that is freedom. Property, low taxes, low regulation. For those who still find themselves unable to make ends meet, I suspect government has to act. Given that the poor law dates back to 1600 or thereabouts, the idea is certainly well established in England. And I think the principle of local relief using local resources is a sound one. On the other hand, I'm prepared to believe that the Popular Guardians are right. Popular has bigger problems and fewer means to deal with them. Given that they are mainly communists, it is possible that they cause the poverty they complain about. But I don't think they've had enough time. The idea that central government intervening to tell Popular what it can and can't do is a repudiation of the localism principle and sets a dangerous precedent. So what else could have been done? The government could have said, when Popular refused to hand over the precepts, "Fine, you will do without the Metropolitan Police, etc.," which is getting into an area of uncertainty I'm sure ministers would prefer to avoid. Or they could have held firm when the guardians were jailed, not always that easy. Or when other London boroughs were required to chip in, those boroughs should have been given representation on the Popular Authority. But I don't think this gets to the nub of the issue. The question is, to what extent poverty in Popular has anything to do with people in Putney or Port Talbot or Pontefract? I don't know the answer to that. As a bit of light relief, one Edgar Lansbury, chairman of the very Popular Board of Guardians we've been talking about, was this week named as co-respondent in a divorce case. I'm glad to say he married the woman, and they had several children, one of whom was the actress Angela Lansbury. Popular's representatives are not the only ones pleading poverty. This week, the United Electric Railways of London, or UERL, announced their results. Yes, once upon a time, London's underground railways, her buses and many of her trams, were under private ownership. UERL has had a rather colourful history. There was something of a mania for building tube railways at the beginning of the century. UERL bought up most of these, the big exception being the Metropolitan, and then realised that the real money was being made by the buses. So they bought the largest bus company. If nothing else, it kept them solvent. So how are they doing? Well, passengers carried is 15% up, but revenue is down. This is what Lord Ashfield, the chairman, has to say. "In fact, it is expected, when all the figures are published, for that the year 1923 will establish a fresh record of 414 journeys per head of the population." Which is an odd statistic, because it all rather depends on what population he is referring to. Does he mean the relatively small area covered by the London County Council, or does he mean the much larger area, much larger than even the modern Greater London, covered by the Metropolitan Police? He then talks about the balance between the various undertakings. "Unluckily, the year 1923 introduced a new factor into this situation. A number of omnibuses working largely in independence one of another, and, so far as can be ascertained, not in any regular manner, but changing routes daily, one might without exaggeration say hourly, have appeared upon the streets, growing slowly week by week, until at the end of January there were 208 of them in 74 separate ownerships. Their intention appears to be to snatch a doubtful gain by snatching at the cream of the traffic without a thought of what is to be done for the thin milk and without a care for what is meant by public service. Snatching at the cream of the traffic, indeed. What his competitors are doing is satisfying a market that his company has neglected. That is what a public service is. Anyone can acquire an omnibus, which, so long as it complies with the structural requirements of the police, must be licensed by them and may then be employed upon any route within the area which is not physically dangerous without regard either to the capacity of the route or to the vehicular traffic that it already carries, or to the provision of a regular scheme of transport facilities. This is balderdash. Unless I'm very much mistaken, buses are not the main cause of congestion. The main cause is cars, followed by goods vehicles. A bus, if anything, by taking passengers out of cars and therefore cars off the road, reduces congestion. But more to the point, if congestion causes a bus to slow, passengers are less likely to want to use it. The new operator would be undermining his own profitability. And anyway, UERL, or in this case, the London General, holds all the cards. It has a larger fleet, more staff, and bigger pockets. It is much easier for it to increase the number of services, man them, and probably cheaper too. In all the great cities of the world, there is even more than a mere discretion. There is effective control. In London, there is nothing. Ah, yes. The abroad is better argument, aided by the fact no one has ever been there. Some remedy must be found for the competition that is destructive, or sooner rather than later, London will wake suddenly to find that its traffic facilities are growing less instead of greater. The remedy, of course, was state ownership. And did that lead to greater facilities? Hardly. Despite this attempt to put the competition out of business, there is evidence that Ashfield is paying at least some attention to the day job. We foresaw that the lift consumed too much of the passengers' time, and so we resorted to escalators, of which 20 are now installed, and 29 are in course of being installed at all the important stations, which, not being too deep, can be adapted to their use. The underground network is still expanding, both in terms of track length and trains. But it is not incapable of improvement. This is a letter from a Mr. G. Grant McKenzie from Thursday the 21st of February. The underground authorities would do well to give their urgent attention to the dangers of overcrowded station platforms. It is surprising that more accidents do not occur through people being pushed onto the line. Only a very simple precaution is required. A barrier should be erected along the edge of each platform with just the necessary gaps to permit entrance to the trains. The gap should be protected by a second and parallel barrier extending the length of the gap and about 3 feet from it. Of course, this requires trains to stop in exactly the right place, like they do in Japan, where most operators are, by the way, privately owned. I think the first platform barrier in Britain didn't come about until the Jubilee Line extension in 2000. London is beset with transport problems, but there is a massive thoroughfare that runs right through the centre of London, which is hardly ever used. So could the Thames offer a solution? M.W. Ray of County Hall, I presume he is a councillor, thinks not. This is from Monday the 18th of February. It is interesting to note that the Secretary of the London Progressive Association is raising the question of steamboats on the Thames and appears to indicate that he is in favour of the LCC, that's the London County Council, renewing what proved to be, from the point of view of the ratepayers, a very costly experiment. He complains that the LCC steamboats were never given a fair chance. But surely he remembers that they were commenced under Progressive auspices. It would appear that the Progressives are a political party. The members of that party based their expectations of success on the estimate that 33 million of passengers would be carried each year. Instead of that number, only about 3.5 million were carried, surely sufficient proof that there was no popular demand for the service. For comparison, the number carried by UERL, mentioned earlier, is about 2 billion. The experiment cost London hundreds of thousands of pounds, and the policy received the condemnation of the ratepayers at successive elections. A small fleet of steamers would have little effect on the volume of London traffic, especially as it would have to compete directly with the very efficient tramway, omnibus, and underground railway services. Some 30-odd years ago, I did commute by riverboat, once. It was slower, less frequent, and more expensive than the alternatives. And the view wasn't very good, and it lost money. Oddly enough, in researching this segment, I did check on the current situation. There is a service. It's not particularly quick. It's not particularly frequent. It's not particularly cheap. But apparently, it does make money. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.